So I want to spend a few minutes walking through the text that was read for us at the beginning of our time together. Like I said at the beginning, Good Friday is a day where we're specifically remembering and reflecting on the crucifixion, so the death of Jesus. And it's a somber day, like we've mentioned, and it's meant to be that way. The theme for our service this morning is "Look Who We Killed." And if you've been attending our church, you know that we've been walking through the Gospel of Matthew for several years now as a church. And it's been interesting to see how Matthew writes and specifically what he wants us to see as the readers. Matthew's whole point for writing this gospel that we have is that he's building a case. He is trying to show beyond the shadow of a doubt that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. That's really important to remember as we walk through this account of the crucifixion of Jesus in Matthew's gospel. Because you'll notice that Matthew doesn't really dwell on the horrific details of how physically brutal crucifixion was. Matthew is much more interested in us seeing people's reactions to Jesus. There really are no attempts to play on the heartstrings of the readers. Matthew just writes a plain account of what happened on that day. So I just wanted to walk through the text this morning, and specifically we want to look at, well, what were people's responses to Jesus? And then ask, well, who is this Jesus whom they crucified? So the first response, we won't read the whole text again, but is that of the soldiers. We're told in verse 32 that Jesus is led out of the city and the soldiers get a man named Simon to carry his cross because Jesus was so weak from the beating and the flogging that he had undergone. They bring him to a place called Golgotha, and in verse 34 we read that they offered him wine mixed with gall. Now that act was done for and to Jesus really for two purposes. One, it was an additional mockery of Jesus. Wine, in that case for prisoners, would be mixed with this bitter herb, this gall is what it was called, that was actually poisonous. So it wasn't like a pleasant drink that they offered Jesus. Please don't read it as, well, these soldiers are nice. They're just kind of, they feel bad for Jesus and they're offering him a drink. That's actually not the case. The taste of the drink would have been putrid. It's actually named after the bile in your intestines. That's where the word gall comes from. That's how putrid it tasted. So on one hand, the soldiers, they're just mocking Jesus one last time. But secondly, this drink, as terrible as it would have tasted, it was often used as a sedative, because it's poison, essentially. It was a sedative to dull the pain. So please notice that Jesus refuses it. And that's very important. Jesus is going to undergo immense pain spiritually and physically, and he refuses to be under the influence of sedatives. Jesus wants to be in the right frame of mind to face what he's going to have to face. So no one can say, well, yeah, Jesus died for our sins, but he was drugged up. That's not the case. Jesus refused what was offered him. In verses 35 to 37, we read, and when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there, and over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." So really, the soldiers are just ambivalent towards him. We learned last Sunday, if you were here with us in our services, that the soldiers mocked Jesus as the king. So obviously they didn't really believe that. And we're told that they crucify him naked, and then at the foot of the cross, they begin to bet on who gets to take his clothing home. And then they nail a sign above him with his criminal charge. This is what Jesus was crucified for, because he claimed to be the King of the Jews. And there's almost this mocking tone in that inscription. What kind of king would be crucified? I mean, kings are meant to be powerful and persuasive, and they're the ones that would punish people. And now here's Jesus, this supposed king, and he's hanging on a cross. So you can see the soldiers, their response to Jesus was just nothing. They had no reverence or respect. They were just following orders. Jesus was just another run-of-the-mill criminal that they would have crucified. Verses 39 and 40 says this, "Those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, 'You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross.'" So we see the general public's attitude towards Christ. They deride him, and deride just means to ridicule and laugh at. So they're mocking him. They walk by and they shake their heads and they say, "Look at you. Jesus, you said you were going to do all these things, and now you're hanging on a cross. If you are the Son of God, well, come down. Like, prove it. If you really are the King, like Jesus, if you are who you say you are, then just take yourself off the cross and prove it. If you are the Son of God," and if you've been studying Matthew with us, like, where have we heard that language before? All the way back in Matthew chapter 4 when Jesus was tempted in the desert. This was the same accusation that Satan threw at him. "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." "Jesus, if you are the Son of God, well then throw yourself off of the temple and God will save you." See, all throughout Jesus' ministry, people demanded signs from him. Basically, "Prove it, Jesus. You say you're special and you're God's Son. Well, prove it." Because no one was expecting that the Messiah, the Son of God, would come and be humble, would come and be poor, would come and serve the least, would come and die. That's why they don't believe him, because he didn't meet their expectations. Surely, the Son of God, the Messiah, someone that unique and important and powerful, wouldn't be nailed to a cross. So prove it. Come down, Jesus. Jesus' present helpless situation would have been seen in the crowd's eyes as proof that Jesus wasn't who he said he was. Verse 41, "So also the chief priests with the scribes and the elders mocked him, saying, 'He saved others. He cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him, for he said, I am the Son of God.'" So you see this picture. I mean, the soldiers view Jesus. He's just another run-of-the-mill criminal. The crowds pass by and mock him and laugh at him, believing that he's a liar. He's not who he says he is. And now we have the religious leaders. So, like, picture that. This would be the pastors of the day, the chief priests, the scribes, the elders, and they're mocking him, but kind of to one another. "Hey, look at this Jesus. He can't even save himself. He's the King of Israel. If Jesus would come down from the cross," the chief priests say, "well, then we would believe in him." Even though we know that they wouldn't. What they're doing is just rubbing salt in the wounds. Because remember, the chief priests and the religious leaders and the scribes, they were Jesus' number one enemy. They hated him. And now, seemingly, they've won. They go, "Look, now we're just going to rub salt. Oh, you said you were the King of Israel. Well, come down and we'll believe in you, King. If Jesus really was the Son of God, well, surely then God, his Father, would rescue him." So in their minds, because Jesus is hanging on a cross, it means that everything he said about himself was false. God wasn't saving him. He couldn't even save himself. Here's the supposed king. And look at him now. So I really believe that Matthew is painting this picture for us. The overwhelming majority of the Jewish people did not believe that Jesus was who he said he was. They rejected him as their Messiah. They scorned him. They mocked him. And look at the irony. I mean, as they're hurling insults at Jesus, they have no idea what they're saying. "Destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. That's what you said, Jesus." And when Jesus spoke those words, he was talking about his very own body. So really, that's coming true as he hangs on the cross. "Come down from the cross. Jesus saved others, but he can't save himself. If he were the Son of God, God would rescue him." And we know, as the reader, Jesus did save others. And he would continue to save others, but the reason he can continue to save others is because he stayed on the cross. Not that he would come down. Jesus could have come down from the cross and destroyed his enemies with power, but he didn't. He chose to stay on the cross and accomplish his Father's will. So if you think about our theme, you know, look who we killed. If you were to ask the soldiers and the crowds and the religious leaders that question, who are you killing? They would have said an imposter, a liar, a maniac, a nobody, a blasphemer, a threat. That's who we killed. But is that true? Was Jesus actually an imposter? Was he just maybe just a good teacher who crossed the line maybe when he said some things that he said? Or we have to ask the question, is Jesus who he says he is? And if you look at the rest of the evidence surrounding his death, it becomes clear that this is much more than just an ordinary man. And when you dig into the text a bit, you begin to see what is going on spiritually as Jesus hangs on the cross. Verse 45 tells us from the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. So what is with that? The sixth hour was noon, and the ninth hour was 3 p.m. So from 12 noon till 3 p.m., the middle of the afternoon, darkness descends on the land. And lots of skeptics and scholars have tried to maybe explain this away. Well, maybe it was just an eclipse. But that's impossible because Jesus was crucified during the Passover, and the Passover occurs always during a full moon. And solar eclipses cannot happen when it's a full moon. It's scientifically impossible. Well, maybe it was just a dust storm. I mean, this is the Middle East. It's dusty over there. Maybe just a big dust storm kicked up and it blocked out the sun. Impossible. This is the rainy season. The Passover always takes place in the rainy season. So what happened then as Jesus hung on the cross and darkness came for 3 hours was supernatural. Now, in several places in the Old Testament, supernatural darkness is seen as a visible sign of the judgment of God. The clearest one that you probably, if you've grown up in the church, can think of is in Exodus, when God sends the plague of darkness on the Egyptians as a sign of his judgment against them. And so as Jesus hangs on the cross, darkness comes over the land for 3 hours, and it was in those moments that the judgment of God against sin, God's wrath and anger against the sin of mankind, was poured out onto Jesus. That's why in verse 46 it says that the ninth hour Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now listen, all throughout the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus always refers to God as his Father. But never in the Gospel of Matthew until this moment has God ever referred to God as simply my God. It's always Father. There's always intimacy in his description of this relationship between him and the Father. And so as Jesus hangs on the cross and the sin of the world is placed on him, the judgment of God is poured out onto Jesus, something in the relationship between the Father and the Son appears to be broken. Now, to be sure, this is not a loss of faith on Jesus' part in the goodness of his Father, but there's a temporary loss of contact. Jesus has been forsaken by God. And the beautiful thing about this is that Jesus was forsaken so that you would never have to be. So for 3 hours, darkness descends on the land, and wave after wave of God's judgment is poured out onto Jesus, because Jesus has told us that he had to drink the cup of God's wrath. So I believe that Jesus, as he cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's not crying out in bewilderment or you know, just crying out because of his plight. But I think Jesus was expressing and witnessing to the world that he was experiencing God-forsakenness for the salvation of others. Because we know Jesus, he knew that this was coming. It's not as if he was caught off guard. So I believe Jesus is crying out as a testimony to the world. He's saying, I'm being forsaken so you don't have to be. Verse 50 tells us, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice, and yielded up his spirit. Notice that. Jesus yielded up his own spirit. Jesus is in full control. No one takes his life from him, but he freely gave it. I mean, even in John 10, Jesus says, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. This charge I've received from my Father." Jesus willingly dies. Yes, the chief priests and the elders accused him. Yes, Pilate delivered him to be crucified. Yes, the soldiers drove nails through his hand. But Jesus yielded his own spirit. Now, Matthew records for us just unbelievable events that happened the moment that Jesus died. Verse 51 says, "And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks were split, the tombs were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many." These are not normal things. I don't know if you're aware of that. These aren't normal things that happen when someone dies. So listen, as a pastor, I've been with families whose loved ones are passing away, and I've seen in my life, not many, but I've seen people die. And in that moment, earthquakes don't happen. In that moment, when someone dies, dead people in the cemetery don't come back to life. So this is not normal. Jesus dies and he yields up his spirit and unbelievable things happen. The curtain of the temple's torn in two from top to bottom. And so if you're not aware, the curtain of the temple was this thick, heavy curtain that separated the holy place from the most holy place. And the most holy place was where the high priest, once a year, would go in, and the presence of God was there, and he would offer sacrifices on behalf of the people. And so that thick curtain separated people from the presence of God, and it was torn in two from top to bottom. And so it means that that separation was removed. Hebrews 9 says, "He, being Jesus, entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption." Hebrews 10, "Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that he opened for us through the curtain, that is, through his flesh, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." So the moment Jesus dies, the temple is torn in two, an earthquake happens, rocks split, and dead people come back to life. Like, after Jesus is raised from the dead, we're told these resurrected people go into the city and appear to people. Like, we should all go, "What in the world?" So there's something drastically different about the death of Jesus. This doesn't happen when normal, ordinary people die. That's why in verse 54 we see this final response from the centurion and the guards who were watching over Jesus. Remember the guards who were ambivalent? Jesus is just another criminal. But as Jesus yields his spirit and all of these unbelievable things happen, it says, "When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" They saw how he died. They saw the darkness come over the land, unexplainable darkness. They saw the earthquake and the rocks split. They see all of these supernatural things take place. And their response is, okay, there was something different about this man. They begin to go, okay, well, now look who we killed. This is the Son of God. Now, whatever the soldiers meant by that declaration, this is a climactic theological moment in the book of Matthew. See, all along, several times, we've seen different individuals declare that Jesus is the Son of God. We've seen God the Father declare that in Matthew 3 and Matthew 17. He says, "This is my son." We've seen demons recognize Jesus as the Son of God in Matthew 4 and in Matthew 8. Jesus himself said that he was the Son of God in Matthew 11 and in Matthew 24. His disciples declared that he was the Son of God in a moment of crisis. In Matthew 14, Peter declared that Jesus was the Son of God in Matthew 16. But up to this moment in the book of Matthew, no one outside of the disciple group has used such language of Jesus. And now, in the moment of his death and these cataclysmic supernatural events happen, Roman pagan guards realize that Jesus is the Son of God. They've killed the king. They've killed an innocent man. They've killed God's own son. So like I said, our theme for this year's service was "Look Who We Killed." And I realized that it can be very tempting to look back at the chief priests and the religious leaders and Pilate and the Roman soldiers and point back at them and say, "Well, they killed Jesus." And physically, that may be true. And it can be really hard, 2,000 years removed from these events, to place ourselves there and see the part that you and I played in the crucifixion of Jesus. But in reality, it wasn't just them that killed Jesus. Jesus went to the cross and he hung. As he hung there, the sin of the world was laid on him. So that means your sin, your rebellion, your disobedience, your perversion, your depravity. And as darkness came over the land, the judgment and the wrath of God against your sin and against my sin was poured out onto Jesus. Jesus was forsaken instead of you. Jesus suffered God's wrath instead of you. Jesus went to the cross instead of you. And Jesus died for you, instead of you, and because of you. Like, we have to remind ourselves that. So in reality, when we say, "Well, look who we killed," we mean, look who you killed. Look who I killed. Jesus, the innocent one, the Son of God, killed for me. Now, if we just left it there, I mean, the guilt of that would be crushing on us. But the good news of the gospel is that Jesus willingly did this for you. Jesus yielded up his own spirit. Jesus willingly went to the cross to suffer and die. Jesus, the Son of God, the innocent one, the only perfectly sinless person to ever live, out of his great love for you, went to the cross. Jesus suffered and died, and he bore the wrath of God so that you would never have to. So yes, we remind ourselves on Good Friday, okay, I actually had a part to play in the death of Jesus. Jesus died for me and instead of me and because of me, and yet we see Jesus willingly doing this. And so the response then is, if we respond like the centurion, when we confess with our mouths that Jesus is Lord, and when we believe in our hearts and we surrender to him, the Bible is very clear. We are forgiven, we are accepted, we're adopted into God's family, we don't fear God's wrath, it's been paid for, we look forward to Jesus' return, we're given a new life, we're cleansed, we're given a new heart, all of these incredible things because of what took place on that cross. So this Good Friday, we wanted to spend some time sitting just in the weightiness of this narrative. And like I said at the beginning, we want to actually discipline ourselves to allow the weight of the cross and the death of Jesus to rest on us, to not rush through it, but to meditate on it and to think about it. And hopefully my prayer is that you would respond to it. If you're here this morning and maybe, you came out of tradition, or your family dragged you here, or it's just something to do, my prayer is that, one, you would realize the gravity of your sin, and two, you would realize the immense love of God, that he would do this to his own son instead of you. So we want to sit in the weightiness of that, but we want to respond to that as well. And like I said, yes, we're going to get to Sunday, and it's going to be great, but we don't want to rush through today. Because like I said, put yourself in the disciples' shoes. I mean, they had no idea theologically what was happening. They had no idea theologically that, yes, we know that Jesus is going to raise from the dead. On Friday night, their world was over. Their leader was dead. The last 3.5 years of their lives for nothing. So I want to close by praying and reading one more passage of Scripture. And like I said earlier, I would invite you back for Sunday. If you are new to the Bible or Christianity, if you only hear this half, then you need to hear the rest of the story. So I would invite you to come back on Sunday. But we're actually just going to allow ourselves and discipline ourselves to just remain in this weightiness. Don't rush your mind to Sunday already. Because I believe if you actually put yourself in the disciples' shoes and you allow the somberness of today to just rest on you, Sunday is going to be way more glorious.